Welcome to The Property Wizard. If you are brand new to the real estate investment world or have limited experience, you've come to the right place. Freddie Crouch has over 35 years of real estate investing experience. He's seen it all, and he's ready to share it with you. This podcast takes an inside look at investing in real estate, what to look for, and most of all, how to move forward. Please welcome the property wizard, Freddie.
Welcome back, everybody. Thank you, faithful listeners. Once again, I would like to thank Nathan Simon for that great tune. Nathan is part of the team at Carl Speaks, which is headed up by no other than podcast guru Carl Richards. To round off the team, cover artwork is being provided by Carolyn Nikolai. Thank you, everyone, for the wonderful effort. So, Bernie, a quick recap from our previous podcast on mortgage financing with our guest, Michelle Lalonde. Any questions, comments? What did you think of it?
It was a great session with Michelle. It's also great to know that a group of people can apply for a mortgage through a syndication. And it becomes a separate business entity. That's really good to know.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it really, really helps a lot of folks get started. You don't have to think of syndications as being a cash-only type transaction where the partners need to come up with the cash to buy the property. If people are of the same mind. We haven't gone there yet, but it's important to note that paying cash for a property isn't necessarily the wisest move when we're calculating return. There's such a thing as margin, and there is a fine line where you can maximize the return that you're receiving on a property with just the right amount of mortgage financing. People can find out a lot more about that if they take our intro course. And maybe what we'll do during one of these podcasts, we'll get into a little more of a math tutorial, but not today. You've got me. Anything in the mailbag, Bernie?
Well, Freddie, yes. Patty asks, where can I get a hold of Michelle?
Okay. As with all our guests, you can get our guest contact information on our podcast notes, which if you go back to your supplier and before clicking on the actual podcast itself, you'll see over to the side. Well, it depends on exactly who and from what podcast library you're listening from. But if you click on your podcast notes, all the contact information for all our guests is listed right there. Email, phone, whatever they've provided is there. I know he'd be tickled pink to hear from you. Patty, thank you for writing in.
Another question from Howie. He really enjoyed the podcast on co-tenancies. Is there one type of property that lends itself better to a co-tenancy situation than another?
Well, that's a bit of a loaded question, but at the end of the day, all properties lend themselves quite nicely to a co-tenancy situation. What a co-tenancy does do, though, is make the acquisition of non-income producing assets a lot easier. For instance, if you were to buy a parcel of land or try to put together a land assembly, in those instances where there may not be any income, of course, a co-tenancy helps to carry the monthly annual costs of holding on to that property, only because it's not up to just you, yourself, or I to turn around and carry the costs associated with the property. You've got a group of people to do just that. So for that particular purpose, look, at a co-tenancy just fits the bill really, really well. But to go back to your original question, there really isn't any particular type of property that a co-tenancy doesn't work for. So thank you very much for the question.
Okay, a couple more questions left. One from Jean. He just started listening to The Property Wizard and really enjoys it. I like the down-to-earth approach, says he. And any plans to take us through some projects you've been involved with?
We were actually, I think, Bernie, weren't we talking about doing a season one wrap up? I think we were, and what we were going to call it, we're going to call it Successes and Lessons Learned. In that particular podcast, which I think we'll probably make a quarterly type event, we'll talk specifically about projects and there's ups and downs and those that have worked maybe better than others. Ideally, you're right. A podcast isn't necessarily the best medium to actually walk you through an existing project, but that doesn't mean we can't put something together on a YouTube channel or possibly, you know, start with an investor and take you through the paces and his trials and tribulations in getting the project done. The short answer is, Yes, possibly. But I think you'll find the upcoming podcast on successes and lessons learned really, really interesting. We'll be talking about some very specific and pretty interesting projects that I personally have been involved with in the past. Great. Thank you very much for writing in again, John.
All right, Fred, here's the last question from Stefan. He just purchased a property which needs a little more work than he anticipated. He spoke about prioritizing your to-do list. And so in one of the podcasts involving property management, what would you say he should take as his first priority?
Well, it really depends on what state or condition the property is in. However, the very first issue that you need to address are health and safety concerns, period. It doesn't matter whether the property is occupied. It doesn't matter if it's vacant. Health and safety concerns are number one. And by that, I mean, if you're taking over a vacant property, for instance, and the stairs are rickety or the banisters are broken or non-existent, you need to address those particular items first. So along with securing the property, if again it's vacant, is addressing health and safety concerns. I cannot emphasize that enough. It is very, very important as a property owner, and your insurance company would most definitely insist on it if they were to conduct an inspection, which is not that unusual in today's climate. A lot of insurance companies that are insuring properties, commercial investment type properties, will provide you with a list of what they consider deficiencies. And first and foremost, they will always be issues surrounding health and safety. So address those first. And if you have any questions further as to what constitutes health and safety, write me back. I'm happy to answer your email or re-listen to our podcast on property management. I think we touched on a few points there, didn't we, Bernie?
If they're going to send you information, it's to info@gentryres.com. So it's info@gentry, G-E-N-T-R-Y, the res, R-E-S.com, and Gentry Res is all one word.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Bernie, for that. We may not be able to get to all your questions during the limited time we have to record our podcast. However, if we weren't able to get to your question, we will always respond via email as we have in the past. Okay, good. I think that wraps up the mailbag. That's fantastic. Seems that we're getting a lot of good positive comments and some really interesting questions too. It proves that people are listening. Good stuff. So, next segment.
From the current events desk of the Property Wizard, it's news of the week.
So, Fred, what's in the news bag today?
I've been doing quite a bit of reading about this three-way battle, and some would suggest four-way battle, that's developing between the province, municipalities, and non-sprawlers, and the Not In My Backyard special interest groups, all referencing this need for affordable housing. And there's a great deal of information, articles, pundit views being written from all sides. But needless to say, it's really creating a lot of stress for municipal politicians. They're under a deadline to make adjustments to their urban boundaries by July of 2022. That's not that far away. Essentially, the provincial government says you make the necessary changes to your urban boundary, or we're going to come in and do it for you. So then the municipalities have to deal with the special interest groups, those that don't want an expansion of the urban boundary and those that don't want an increase in intensification in their neighborhoods. So I came across this article written by Tim Hudak, who's the head of the Ontario Real Estate Association. And you got to give credit where credit is due. So let me read part of what he's written. The Ontario Real Estate Association is calling for an end to exclusionary single-family zoning rules in high-density areas and near transit and subway stations in cities across Ontario to combat a housing crisis that is keeping home ownership out of the hands of many. As he says, we've moved from an affordability challenge in Ontario to an affordability crisis. The association further says it makes no sense that it is illegal in many urban neighborhoods of Ontario to convert a single-family home into a townhome, duplex, triplex, or fourplex without a zoning bylaw change, while it's relatively easy to convert an outdated wartime bungalow into a monster four-story home for one wealthy family. However, if the property owner wanted to take that same house and create affordable homes for up to four families, it's an expensive process. There's delays, there's what he calls NIMBY, not in my backyard forces, that stop the process right in its tracks. You have to go through an entire zoning process, which could take up to a year or more and cost tens of thousands of dollars in fees, let alone legal costs. Many forces use delaying tactics to empty the wallets of those that want to develop these homes, so they don't even bother in the first place. That means that affordable homes are even more scarce in urban centers. Another point that he makes is that, and this is a quote, back in the disco era, there were sweeping changes across Ontario that eliminated secondary suites in many neighborhoods. In the long run, it meant so many rental units are in large buildings. We think you should give people a greater choice. Allowing more secondary suites will open up new neighborhoods for rental units, increase affordability for tenants, and enable homeowners to use the rental income to pay their mortgages down 15 to 25% faster. Sounds to me like it's a win-win-win situation, and I really hope the municipalities turn around and jump on the opportunity to make real change here. So at the end of the day, let's hope municipalities take a balanced approach, mitigating the need to expand the urban boundary by promoting responsible intensification. And what that means for our listeners is that there's going to be hopefully a real opportunity for smaller investors to buy property, redevelop them into multiple units. I think it's a sound idea and really answers both areas of concern. The need for an expanded urban boundary, which no one is going to suggest or be able to take that need away. It's there. It's going to happen just by sheer numbers. And also the need for a certain amount of intensification. So that could be and should be great news for all our investors out there. So stay tuned. Hopefully I'll have a little more information on it as plans and the deadline approaches. Thank you. Thank you, one and all. Any questions on that?
Yeah, Fred. Actually, how intensified can they get till it's not doable?
I think at the end of the day, it's going to be difficult to sell the construction of three, four, five, six-story building in the middle of a well-established residential neighborhood. That may or may not be, depending on where it's located, being realistic. But I think you're going to start off with seeing people starting to put secondary units in their homes. And like Hudak says, it only makes sense. It makes sense for so many different reasons. You create an affordable housing unit, and you also have the added benefit of income coming into your property. As you know, and as our listeners know, I'm a strong advocate of if your lifestyle dictates buying your own home. But what I've always said is that don't rest on your laurels, turn around and make something of that home in the sense of you may be single, you may have a significant other, you may or may not have kids. But very often, there's room in any home to put a secondary suite, an in-law suite, an apartment, maybe even some sort of, you know, exterior mini home, which you don't see a great deal of yet here, but is quite common out in the East Coast. So at the end of the day, I think what we're going to see is, and what I'm hoping to see from municipalities is a very balanced approach. I'm not saying let's throw these, you know, four or five, six-story buildings in the middle of well-established residential communities. It's just not going to fly for so many reasons. Let's start off with allowing homeowners a little more liberty when it comes to adding additional suites or renting out their units. I mean, one very interesting point was made. I had a conversation with someone yesterday, was that just allowing two doors in front of your house would be a great step forward, meaning that you could have two front doors and someone could come in and actually either go down or up to a secondary unit. And a lot of homes will lend themselves really nicely to that. I know it may seem like an insignificant point to many, but those are the type of things that are standing in the way from real development and solving this housing crisis, little things like that. And what I would like to see is baby steps, slow intensification. And I always categorize it by saying responsible intensification. You know, you don't want to go in like a bull in a china shop. You need to do things tastefully. But the days where neighborhoods and neighbors can band together and say, not in my backyard, You can't have it both, because very often those very same people are the people that don't want urban expansion. Well, you can't have it both ways. So I'm saying give a little in both camps and we may be able to get through this, but this is not, you know, an overnight type of, you know, a solution. This is something that's going to take time, but there's lots of room for entrepreneurs and real estate developers and property owners to make or take real advantage of the situation by, you know, buying lots and developing multiple units on these lots, by taking even single family homes and creating secondary units in them. There is real opportunity here. So don't be blind to that fact. It's not all bad news, but the only way this issue is going to be resolved, and again, I don't want to go on and on about it, but it's not by addressing demand side issues. It's not. It's as simple as that. The reason why we have a problem today is strictly because of supply. The laws of supply and demand hold true, not just for real estate, but any product or good. So you need to deal and address the supply side, not the demand. And I'm really quite surprised more people haven't picked up that banner. So anyways, we're going to leave it at that. Well, I have the distinct honor of introducing our very patient guest, Mark Habib. Hi, Mark. How you doing? Welcome. Mark has been a lawyer in Ottawa for 31 years. He is with the law firm of Habib and Associates, where he practices primarily residential and commercial real estate. He is a former trustee with the County of Carleton Law Association, the CCLA. He is also a member of the CCLA Real Estate Lawyers Committee, which oversees legal issues affecting the local real estate bar. Thank you for joining us, Mark. Real pleasure having you on board.
Oh, good morning, Fred and Bernie. It's a pleasure to be here today and join this podcast.
Did I miss anything? I think that's a pretty succinct bio. I'm really impressed by your participation with the CCLA. That's pretty amazing. Good for you.
Yeah, thank you. And, you know, I was listening with interest to the questions about intensification. And if I could chime in here briefly and point out that in Ottawa, it's been the case for the past several years that putting in a secondary unit in a residential property is permitted pretty well across the board. My experience with that, however, is that the homeowner still has to get all the necessary building permits and fire code upgrades to allow for that to occur. And there are some zoning related problems with it as well. For example, I was at a property in Vanier where they said the secondary units were permitted, but there was a limit on how many vehicles could be parked on that particular street. So you can imagine you have a small street, perhaps, that your home is on. You know, everybody on the street wanted to put a secondary dwelling in. Well, where are you going to put all the cars? What kind of problems that can create?
Yeah, great point. You're absolutely right. That's a great point, Mark. I think the municipality, City of Ottawa, has really come along. There's still room for improvement. And I think what UDAC is actually proposing, essentially getting rid of R1 zoning altogether, the exclusionary aspect of just having a single family dwelling, is really going to go a long way in expediting the process and helping municipalities with the vision that Ottawa, at least, is really, I think they've really improved on, quite frankly. Absolutely. They really have. Now, if we could get the permit time down to a more reasonable timeline, I think everybody would be, you know, applauding. But that is a fantastic point. Thank you for bringing that up. That's tremendous. So we have a few questions prepared. We'll see where this conversation takes us, Mark. We'll start off with, prior to submission, what kind of things should or can a buyer do prior to submitting an offer in order to protect themselves?
I guess first and foremost, I mean, getting pre-approved to make sure your financing is in place, or at least that you have a good idea of what you're going to need to buy a property and to borrow money. It may require you to kind of have somebody independent look at your financial situation and see what is. Maybe you have to reduce some debt. Maybe you have to clean up your credit bureau. These are really critical things, because you don't want to go through the process of going to the trouble of putting an offer in and then trying to get your financing in order, only to find out you've got all kinds of problems there that are going to hold up your ability to get financing. So that would be my number one issue, is really to make sure that you've got your ducks in a row to proceed with an application for mortgage financing. The second thing that I think is really important is that it's never really too early to approach a real estate lawyer with your vision of what you hope to do. You know, most of the time, new clients come to us after having already been through the process of buying a home or putting an offer in or working with their real estate agent. But there's no rule that says that you can't talk to a lawyer at or about the same time that you engaged your real estate agent. You know, there may be a particular type of issue that is of interest or relevant to the buyer's circumstances that a lawyer can really assist with. And that might be, you know, it might be a rental property. They want to buy a rental property. Well, if it's a rental property, you know, I would say make sure you get a copy of the leases as early in the process as you can so that the lawyer can have a look and see if there's anything in those leases that might be of concern. The other thing that I might tell a buyer is, look, if you're looking to buy a property in a certain neighborhood or you have a plan to develop the property in a certain manner, do your due diligence and go to the city of Ottawa, you know, see if there's any zoning restrictions for that neighborhood. If you're looking to buy a property that's waterfront, check in with the local conservation authority to see if there are any restrictions that might apply to that property that might, you know, prevent you from developing it in the way that you want to develop it. You might want to talk to neighbors or in the area as well and just kind of really get a feel for, you know, the area that you're going to be buying in.
Let's just say I have a client who is developing a small piece of property, maybe a property that where a single family home used to sit, and they're planning on putting in maybe a three-door row. How much time would you suggest in today's market in Ottawa would it take to get some sort of zoning verification that what they want to do is actually a permitted use? Do you find that most municipalities, the people that you're dealing with, they're getting a reasonable response or a return of a query within a reasonable period of time? You know, all things COVID related today?
I think things are getting a little bit better than they used to be. We always found dealing with the municipality, zoning, or building department very slow. I often will direct my client to go down to City Hall or contact those departments. And usually the fellow at the zoning department is usually a 1 to 2 day turnaround time and for them to send you the list of permitted uses and that type of thing. From my standpoint, let's say I get an offer in and it turns out it's a triplex property currently, and I want to verify it. Well, I would order something called a report on compliance with respect to both the building and zoning components. It costs about $300. I have to send that into the city, usually courier it in, and historically it would take about a month to get a written reply from the city. They used to have an expedited process, but I have not seen that in many years now. And the city is just, they don't seem to have the adequate amount of staff to provide these in a timely way. It's unfortunate because quite often when I get an offer in and I only have perhaps 2 weeks to do the due diligence and the title search and what we call an off-title search. An off-title search would be just that. It would be a request to the city to provide information on zoning and building and fire and, you know, those types of things. If I only get that reply back after the time period, what we call a requisition period, it doesn't help my client too much to find out after the fact or a day before closing that we get a reply from the city. You know, the zoning doesn't permit a triplex, or that the city records only show that it's a legal duplex, not a triplex. And these are problems that, you know, we've actually experienced from time to time in the real world. And it's really difficult, especially in the current market conditions, because, you know, people are buying properties without conditions. There's multiple offers going in on properties, and it's a real challenge, you know. So, I mean, obviously, if the more time that we have to do these required searches, the better. My advice would be to, you know, if you're going to put in your best offer, go ahead and put the best offer in, but don't close it so quickly. Give yourself enough time. Give the lawyer enough time. Give the banker enough time to do what needs to be done so that all the required searches and due diligence and financing steps can take place. So, you know, my preference is to see closing dates at least 2 months out from the date that the agreement is signed.
That's actually some really great advice, you know, especially I suppose that's a perfect lead up to our next question, Mark. In today's market, where even income investment properties are seeing multiple offers, what steps or what precautions can a buyer take to protect themselves?
Aside from some of the things we talked about, like trying to do your due diligence, it's an income property, get copies of those leases as early as you can. Talk to tenants or neighbors if you can. If no condition, you know, go to the city, see if you can find some information to see if you can get any history on the property. One of the things that can be included in your offer are something called warranties. So you could have your realtor could draft a clause called a warranty whereby the seller warrant, or by the term warrant, I mean guarantee a certain state of effects about the property. For example, that the vendor warrants that the appliances will all be in good working order on the day of closing, or that the vendor warrants that all of the leases that are in place are legal and that there are no, you know, disputes with any of the tenants, or all the rents are paid up to date and will be paid up to date. Those are called warranties. Those are also somewhat problematic because now what we're seeing with those types of clauses, those warranties are only binding on the seller on the day of closing, and they don't typically extend beyond the closing date. So with respect to appliances, I always tell my client, you know, when you get the keys, go and do a load of laundry, run the dishwasher. Because if you wait a week to tell me that the dishwasher is not working and, you know, I have to write to the other lawyer to advise them that it's not working, they're going to come back and say, well, it was working fine on the day of closing, unless the buyer actually ran that appliance on the day of closing. There's no recourse. So
just about that specific issue, could you, when writing a warranty clause, let's say we're not dealing with specific appliances, but we're talking about legality of rents, something along those lines. Could you not also structure it so that it reads the seller warrants and said warranties shall survive closing?
Yes, you could certainly do that. And you can put a time limit on it, you know, that they warrant it for 30 days. They'll warrant it for a 1 year period. The difficulty, of course, is that in this market, sellers don't want to guarantee anything. There's so many people lined up to buy properties that if you're acting for the buyer, if you're the buyer and you put in any kind of clause that might cause a seller to reject your offer over somebody else's that doesn't have that clause, that's the risk that you take.
So, Mark, what are the avoidable issues you see with client purchases for investment properties?
Avoidable.
Incorporation, not being incorporated might be one of them.
Yeah, well, it's certainly incorporating. It's not, you know, it really depends on the client. And there are benefits of incorporating and there's some negative things about incorporating. I mean, you know, if you have a corporation, you've got a whole second set of tax returns that you have to do every year. Accountant fees are going to be at least $2,500 a year for accounting fees. So getting financing can sometimes be a challenge when you have a company. And certainly from the legal standpoint, clients who use a corporation to buy a piece of property will typically find the legal fees a little on the higher side than if it was purchased through their personal name, simply because there are additional documents that the lawyer has to prepare when acting for a corporation that is buying a piece of property. For example, you might have to have a special resolution drawn up to authorize the company to buy the piece of property or to borrow the money from the bank. And the minute book for the company has to be reviewed and updated because a corporate opinion has to be given to the bank about the legality of the company and whether or not it's all its minute book and annual resolutions are up to date, that kind of thing. So that's part of the answer to your question. We're talking about avoidable issues.
When it comes to verifying income, could you just explain to our listeners, and this is interesting because we actually posted this on our Instagram account, I believe, purpose of an estoppel certificate when it comes to verifying income. And who is responsible for verifying the expenses related to the property? The taxes is pretty easy. Is it smart or should it be part of the agreement of purchase and sale that the seller provide the buyer with maybe an historical accounting like their regular gas bills, hydro bills for common elements? Does that suffice? So that's a two-part question. Estoppel certificates and verifying expenses.
Don't always see estoppel certificates. And a estoppel certificate is really, it's a document whereby the seller certifies certain information to the buyer about revenues and expenses related to the property. And quite frankly, I haven't seen them very often. You tend to see them more in commercial deals. But for the average, you know, multi-unit property where a buyer is, you know, needs to know, like, what's the taxes? What are the utility costs, heat and hydro and things like that? One thing that should be pointed out is sometimes we'll see in the MLS listing that there has been some disclosure by a seller as to what those costs and expenses and revenues are. It should be pointed out by the real estate agent to the buyer that the information that is contained on an MLS listing is not warranted to be accurate. And in fact, the MLS listing at the bottom of the page very specifically states, while the information is believed to be accurate, it's not warranted. And I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've got clients, you know, at the closing day, they're saying, wait a minute, you're showing that the property taxes are $5,000 a year. Well, the MLS listing said they're only $3,500, way off. Well, there's not really too much we can do when we point out to the buyer that that information on the MLS listing is never to be relied upon. So really, it is incumbent upon the realtor, in my view, to, if he can, get that information up front or include it in the agreement of purchase and sale that the seller shall provide to the buyer within, you know, 5 days, 10 days of acceptance of the offer, you know, the documentation that the buyer wants to see, whether it's the taxes, the heating costs, rent roll, showing what the rents are for each of the units. And again, warranties can be added to that to state that the seller warrants that the information contained in the agreement are accurate.
Brilliant. That is a fantastic explanation. So now here's a question I get asked. The need and necessity for title insurance. And in part, what are the costs associated with title insurance?
Title insurance was really an American invention and came into Canada, I would say, around 1996. At that point, it was a product that came in by title insurance companies as a means to encourage buyers to title insure their property to avoid the necessity of having an up-to-date survey for a property. Because historically, to buy a house, lawyers always had to have a survey and preferably an up-to-date survey. So when we say up-to-date, would be within 5 years of the date of the purchase. Because a survey is an important document in that it reveals all the boundaries of a property. It would show whether there were any encroachments of structures from neighboring properties onto the property. It would also show if there are any encroachments of the building that you're buying onto the neighboring property, such as decks or fences, those kinds of things. And banks, when they lent money, always required lawyers to give an opinion and to satisfy the bank that the building was wholly within the lot and that there were no such encroachments. It became very, very difficult in Ontario in handling real estate transactions from a legal standpoint, because people stopped wanting to pay for surveys. Surveys were costing anywhere from $1,200 to $1,500 a pop. And they were getting used and reused and, you know, over and over again to the point where they were almost illegible. Well, title insurance was offered as a solution because the title insurance company said, look, you buy this insurance policy, for as long as you own the property, we guarantee to the bank and to the homeowner that if there are any such encroachments or defects that would be shown by a new survey, we will insure the homeowner and the bank up to the value of the property or pay the cost of having to remove an encroachment or, you know, those kinds of things. And title insurance, of course, also covers the home buyer for other matters, such as claims by third parties against the land, such as squatters. It covers a homeowner for any arrears of taxes, water, hydro, gas, any charges that could form a lien on the property, those would be covered as well. It's gotten to the point now with title insurance that almost 100% of all real estate transactions are title insured now. And that's largely because every banking, every financial institution requires that their mortgage be title insured. So when we tell a client that we have to buy title insurance for the bank, we often tell them at the same time, look, we might as well buy you a homeowner policy at the same time, because otherwise we're going to be duplicating a lot of costs and it's just going to end up being more expensive for us to buy the insurance for the bank, but then do all these other searches that we would normally have to do to cover you and to certify title to you.
My next question has to do with partnerships and co-tenancy agreements. Is it safe to say that most lawyers have their own form of partnership or co-tenancy agreement? And could you explain to our listeners, although I've done this in the past, again, it's always best to hear it from a pro source, the difference between tenants in common and joint tenancy. So a two-part question. Do most lawyers have their own form of partnership or co-tenancy agreement when it comes to ownership of real estate and the differences between joint and co-tenants?
Co-tenancy agreement or partnerships agreement, it's safe to say that I think each lawyer has their own format. That may have been a precedent document that they worked with originally or was provided to them. They tend to all deal with the same issues. They're very similar, but there's no set standardized form of document, okay? I think that's safe to say. The second part of your question, which is what's the difference between a tenants in common versus joint tenancy? In this context, the word tenancy is a misnomer. When I say that someone is a joint tenant with me on a property, it has nothing to do with landlord and tenant. It has to do with the capacity in which we own the land. Most husband and wives who own a piece of property or any partners who are in a relationship tend to own properties jointly. And a joint tenancy means that if one of us were to die, the survivor would automatically become the owner of the whole property. The deceased's interest in the property would not pass to their heirs in their will. It would go automatically to the surviving owner. And the best comparison or way to look at it is it's like a joint bank account. So Fred, if you and I have a joint bank account together and we have, you know, money in that bank account and I died, well, all that money in the account is still in your bank account. It happens to be a joint account, but it would become all your money alone. Now, for a tenancy in common, it's the reverse. It would be that whoever died, their share would devolve or pass to their heirs as set out in their will, or if there was no will, it would pass through the intestacy laws of the province, which would essentially mean it goes to your next of kin, okay? It also means that a tenancy in common, it doesn't have to be a 50-50 proposition when it comes to owning the land. You know, you and I could own a piece of property, Fred, and because you put in a bigger down payment, maybe you're going to own 70% of the property and I'm going to own 30%. Okay. Or we could also own it through our companies. Maybe you have an investment company and your investment company owns 70% and mine owns 30%. Again, in that situation, you know, a company can't die, but it would simply mean that at some point in the future, if we ever sell the property, the ownership interest is set out by a percentage.
Yeah, great points. I really wanted you to answer that because we've addressed just those questions in past podcasts, but it is something that repeatedly comes up.
Yes.
So I just thought another voice on it would be tremendous. So with that, Mark, I want to thank you very much for being our guest today. It's been just amazing having you with us today. You answered a lot of questions. If any of our listeners would like to reach you, Mark, how do they get hold of you?
Well, they're certainly welcome to reach out to me anytime. Email is currently the best way to get a hold of me. My email address is mark@markhabiblawyers.com. We have a website, Habib & Associates. You could find us, all our details there. My office phone number is 613-820-8888. And you can like us on Facebook. I've got a number of great articles that have been posted over the years on my Facebook page. You can see all of them still there and reviewable. And please like us on Facebook.
Wonderful, Mark. Thank you. And of course, as with all our guests, if you visit the podcast notes for this specific podcast, all of Mark's contact information is there. So, Mark, once again, thank you so much for agreeing and being such a cooperative guest It's been just really, really great to have somebody of your experience and capacity here. Just wonderful. Thank you again. So with that, we're going to move on to...
It's time for the Property Wizard's Word of the Day.
And I'm going to beg of you, Mark, just one final ask. And you did such a nice job of explaining this earlier. Could you just revisit the term caveat emptor?
Caveat emptor is a Latin phrase. It's a legal words of art, as we call it. And what it means is buyer beware. We can't really rely very much on what a seller has to say in terms of their representations about what they're selling. It's really upon the buyer to do all the necessary due diligence and to craft an agreement that adequately protects them.
Wonderful. Beautiful. Bernie, anything you care to add?
If there are any questions to Fred or to Mark that you want to ask regarding this podcast, send them to info@gentryres.com. That's info@gentryres.com.
Wonderful. And for all our listeners out there, our next podcast will be, as we mentioned earlier, it'll be a wrap up to season one of The Property Wizard. And we're going to talk about successes and lessons learned. It's going to be a bit of a reminiscing exercise for yours truly, but I do have some stories to share and it should be pretty entertaining. Remember, you can save $250 on your next Gentry Learning course by using the phrase podcast, all capitals, one word, when checking out. Wonderful. Again, thank you all for listening. Thank you for subscribing. And remember, if there are no problems, there are no opportunities.
Thanks for joining Freddie on another edition of The Property Wizard. Got a question? Ready to invest? Email info@gentryres.com. And if you'd like to find out more about the courses offered through Gentry Learning, visit gentryres.com. Until next time, remember, if there are no problems, there are no opportunities.